In recent months, we've witnessed a rise in tensions and violence stemming from prejudice of many kinds. As far as we have come as a society, we still have a long way to go to root out this evil from our midst. Now, there's another kind of prejudice, perhaps the term profiling would fit the bill, that even happens in the church. May have even happened already this morning, right here. It goes something like this. Did you read the bulletin this morning? Check out the sermon title. I know. Did you see the pastor's wearing his money tie? Oh boy, here we go again. Yes, there is an ugly prejudice when it comes to preachers and money. I knew of one man, he was an unbeliever, who said, whenever I hear that someone's a preacher, I immediately check for my wallet. Now, I'll admit, there are some preachers out there that have deservedly earned such a reputation, but please, don't paint us all with the same brush. You might be surprised to know that Jesus spoke about money and material possessions more frequently than any other subject other than the kingdom of God. 15% of all that Jesus said has to do with money and material goods. More than his teachings on heaven and hell combined. Of the 38 parables Jesus taught that are recorded in the Gospels, 16 deal with money or possessions. You might wonder, why? Why would Jesus put such an emphasis on this subject? I mean, isn't money the root of all evil? Isn't materialism something that's horrible and we should not have anything to do with? Well, I think there's a fundamental connection between our spiritual lives and how we think about and how we handle money. We may try to divorce our faith and our finances, but God sees that as impossible. Our attitudes and our actions about the one reveals truth about the other. David Allen Hubbard writes, "Show me your checkbook and I'll tell you something about your faith." How we use wealth is a clear-cut indicator of what we think is important. Nothing announces our priorities more sharply than the way we open our wallets and our checkbooks. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to audit everybody's checkbooks and bank accounts today. That's not the point. That's not my chosen field. Frankly, it's none of my business. I'll let you know that when it comes to the tithes and the offerings, I don't know what any of you give, because that's not my business. We have a treasurer and she keeps track of all that, but at no time will I ever go to her and say, hey, could you tell me how much so-and-so is giving? I will never do that. And I would hope that if I asked that, she would say no. That's not the point. And I'm not here to beg for money. I've always said I'm a lousy beggar. And I've learned over the last 14 years that's not necessary in this church. As a church family, you folks are generous in the cause of God, and what we have seen in the recent renovations just proves that. So I'm not up here this morning begging for money. I'm not going to hound you about money, but I do want to focus on what Jesus taught about money. And the Gospels provide ample material. We could preach a whole series of sermons just on this topic, but I'm going to focus on one passage, the passage that was read earlier, Luke chapter 12. Verses 13 through 34. And there's a few different lessons here that are often repeated in the teachings of Christ that I think are important for us on the subject. The passage begins with a man interrupting Jesus as he's teaching others. Did you catch that? It was as it was being read earlier. Jesus is teaching the crowds, and someone in the crowd says, "Teacher, tell my brother to share the inheritance with me." Now, I'm guessing the way that that's phrased, that the brother is there too. Both brothers are probably there. And for some reason, this man doesn't like the way the inheritance of his parents is being handled. So he wants Jesus to settle this dispute. Now, we might be surprised that Jesus would be called upon to solve a family matter. But in those days, it was not uncommon for people to go to the rabbis to have a matter like this settled. We would probably think of calling a lawyer and setting up an appointment and saying, okay, what are my rights here? What's the proper way to go about this? Well, in those days, the rabbis did that. And Jesus was considered a teacher, a rabbi. And so this man asked Jesus for his opinion in this matter. Jesus replies, "Man, who appointed me a judge or an arbiter between you?" In other words, I'm not getting in the middle of this. I'm not touching this with a proverbial 10-foot pole. That's not why he's here, Jesus is saying. Now, you might wonder, why? Why did Jesus not get involved? I mean, he could see into the hearts of these men. He knew what was on their minds. He knew what was fair. He knew what was right. Why didn't he just make a judgment and say, this is the way it ought to be? And I think the reason he refused to get involved is because he could see that the heart of the problem was the problem of the heart. It wasn't the dollars and cents, it wasn't the percentages of the inheritance that was the issue. There was something fundamentally wrong in the heart of the man who asked the question. And frankly, like many people do today, this man wanted Jesus to serve him. He didn't want him to save him. He wanted Jesus to answer the question and solve the problem, but he wasn't interested in what Jesus was offering, what he was teaching. And so Jesus, after pretty much telling this man, no, I'm not getting involved, now he turns to the crowd. Notice it says, and he said to them. He's not just speaking to the individual that asked the question. Now he's addressing the whole crowd of people that are there. And he says, be careful, be on your guard. In this particular part of our passage, Jesus alerts them about avarice. Now, avarice, in another word, covetousness, those are words you find in the Bible. They're not words that we talk about very much today. But they include subjects such as greed, envy, jealousy, materialism. All of these things fall under the category of avarice. And Jesus says, watch out. Be on your guard against all kinds of greed. I thought that phrase was interesting. All kinds of greed. You mean there's more than one? And the answer is yes. In fact, in the New Testament, in the original Greek language, there are three different words that are all translated greed, and they all give us a little different angle on what it's about. The one word means a passionate desire to have something. The other word means to have more, to add to what you already have. And the last word literally means the love of silver, the love of money. Gotta have more. See, greed comes in many manifestations. And Jesus here says, be on your guard. Watch out. This is a temptation that in its many manifestations will come to each and every one of us. Now, I like how Warren Wiersbe describes the word coveting or covetousness. He says it is an unquenchable thirst for getting more and more of something we think we need in order to be truly satisfied. It's an unquenchable thirst, meaning even if you get it, you're not going to be happy. Of something we think we need. There's the key. See, every one of us in our minds think we need certain things that will make our lives happier, that will make us satisfied. Finish this sentence. If I could only have blank, I would be truly happy. How do you fill that sentence? How do you fill that blank? And it doesn't have to be money in and of itself. It may be something money can buy. It may not even be material. It might be a position, a power, a reputation. But whatever you put in that blank that is not God, you will be unsatisfied. That's the whole emphasis of the book of Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament. Solomon literally had it all. God came to him and said, I'll give you whatever you want. And Solomon said, I need wisdom to lead your people. And God was so pleased that he asked for wisdom. He said, I'm going to give you everything else that you didn't ask for. You're going to be the wisest man to ever live. You're going to be the wealthiest man to ever live. You're going to be a powerful king. You're going to have peace and prosperity. You're going to have it all. And Solomon went on a quest, you might say. He went on a little journey. He decided, I'm going to see what of these things truly makes man happy. What makes life worthwhile? And you know what he discovered? None of the above. He tried wealth. He tried work. He tried leisure. He tried pleasures. He tried everything. And nothing satisfied. Why? Because he did everything under the sun. Meaning, without God. I'm going to leave God out of it and try to find happiness on earth, and he couldn't do it. Even though he was the richest man in the world, even though he was the wisest man in the world, even though he was the most powerful man in the world at that time, none of it satisfied. And that's the thing about greed. Greed can never be satisfied. Somebody asked the wealthiest man on earth of his day, the first billionaire on record, John D. Rockefeller, how much money does it take to make a man truly happy? And you know what his answer was? A little bit more. It doesn't matter how much you have, you need a little bit more to be truly happy, which means you'll never get there. And that's what Jesus is warning us about. Mark Twain once said, civilization is a limitless multiplication of unnecessary necessities. Think about that. Unnecessary necessities. We think we need them. We think they're a necessity of life, and they really aren't. But we just keep piling them up anyway. Oftentimes, we confuse our essentials with the extras. We sometimes confuse our needs for our greeds. That can even happen in prayer. See, the problem isn't money. The problem isn't material things. Money is not the root of all evil. How many of you have heard that phrase somewhere down the line? Money's the root of all evil. Bible says so. No, it doesn't. The Bible says the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. It's the love of money. Because even the poorest person can be greedy. Even the poorest person who we think has nothing of this world's goods can still be affected by this sin. It's the love. It's the pursuit. It's that sense that I have to have it. That's what leads to all kinds of evil. Money itself is amoral. It's neither good nor bad in and of itself. But it holds a potential to become a substitute for God. You go through the Bible and money and material goods is constantly portrayed as God's chief competition. And again, it's not the money itself, it's our attitude toward it. I think this is why Paul refers in Colossians 3:5 to greed, and he adds to that verse, which is idolatry. Now, most of us think idolatry is one sin we don't have to worry about. I mean, we don't have statues set up in our house that we go and bow to. We don't pay homage to some wood or stone figure. I mean, that's those old days. We've got that one licked, right? No. An idol is anything that takes the place of God. John ended his first letter in 1 John 5:21 with the words, "Dear children, keep yourselves from idols." And I dare say that most of us today would read that verse and think, "Well, I got that one checked off. No worries there." But I like the way the Living Bible renders that verse. "Dear children, keep away from anything that might take God's place in your hearts." Now we're talking about something different, aren't we? It can be anything. It can be money. It can be what money can buy. It can be that house. It can be that car. It can be that boat. It can be whatever. Anything that takes God's place in our life is an idol, and we've got to beware of it. Do you realize that greed causes a person to break all the other commandments? Ever thought about that? You see, the 10th commandment, the last one, says, "Do not covet." Don't be wanting what somebody else has. Don't look next door and say, "Wow, I wish I had that tractor. Oh, I wish I had that truck. I wish I had that house, that pool, that boat," whatever it might be. But it's not just the 10th commandment. See, when greed comes in, what did Paul call greed? Idolatry. Well, there's commandment one. Then you have the commandment to honor your father and your mother. And we won't go into it today, but if you want to jot this down and look at it later, in Mark 7, verses 9 through 13, Jesus gets on the Pharisees because they were able to get around that commandment when it came to money. Their greed caused them to break that command of honoring your father and mother. The perpetual pursuit of more will cause people to work and make work their God, which may cause them to break the Sabbath principle. They never take time to rest. They never take time to worship. They just work, 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 work. That's a form of idolatry. That's a form of greed. And then, of course, we all know numerous examples of greed leading to theft or adultery or even murder. See, Jesus urges his audience, including us, to keep our priorities straight, to hold material things loosely. Don't grab onto them so that you get white knuckles. Have you ever tried to do that with sand? You ever grab a handful of sand and just try to squeeze it as hard as you can? Do you know what happens? The sand runs out through your fingers, doesn't it? The harder you grip it, the more of it you lose. And I think that's a really good lesson of material things. The more we try to hold on to what this world tells us is important, the more we're going to lose it. And the fact is, as we're going to see a little bit later on, we're going to eventually lose it all. Now, to underscore Jesus' point, he tells a little parable. The parable of the farmer. It's one some of us can relate to, or maybe some of us would like to relate to. Farmer has a bumper crop. He's never had such a great harvest. And he thinks to himself, "Oh man, what am I going to do? I don't have any place to store my crops." Thinks about it and concludes, "I know, I'll tear down my barns, I'll build bigger ones, I'll put up new silos, and I'll store all of my grain, and I'll have plenty for myself for many years, and then I'll just kick back, eat, drink, and be merry." Sounds like a Dairy Queen commercial, doesn't it? God said to him, "You fool. This very night your life will be demanded from you. Then who's going to get what you stored up for yourself?" See, there's nothing wrong with working, and there's nothing wrong with being successful at your work. As long as it's legitimately earned, it's a blessing from God. There's nothing wrong with being financially sensible, investing in the future. You know what the problem was with this particular man? He was selfish. You notice how many times you see me and my and I. These are my crops and I've got plenty to for me for years and I'm going to take it easy. There was no thought of perhaps sharing his wealth with others that were in need. no thought of giving back to God a portion of what God had blessed him with. My appears 4 times in 3 verses. I occurs 8 times in the Greek in this passage. It's all about me, 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 me. Max Lucado puts it this way. This rich man dwelled in a one-house room of mirrors. He looked north, south, east, and west and saw the same individual, himself. I, my. No they, no thee, just me. Even when he said you, he was talking to himself. You have many goods, take your ease. See, he had no regard for God. He speaks of my crops, my barns, my grain. But who gave him those crops? Who gave him the ability to have wealth? It doesn't even occur to him that he has what he has because God has been good to him. What you see here is a practical atheist. Now, he might go around and say he believes in God, but he don't live like it. That's what a practical atheist is. Someone who lives as if there was no God. And no regard for God leads to no regard for others. There's no indication here of meeting somebody else's needs. If someone had approached him about donating some of that excess food to the hungry, he probably would have responded, "Why should I do that? I've earned what I've got. If they want something to eat, they can get a job. This is mine." Sounds pretty American to me, doesn't it? Nowadays, we would probably hail this farmer as a success story. News reporters would be out to interview him. He might even write a bestseller. But God had a little different evaluation of his life, didn't he? You fool. We'd probably say today, you're an idiot. What's the matter with you? Why? Because he took what things were not going to last and disregarded the things that would. He thought that he could live for years and years, and what he forgot was that wasn't his call. Oh, he had plenty stored up to live comfortably for years and years, but who gives him life? He forgot about that. He forgot that there's no guarantee of tomorrow. And what happens when this life ends? Eternity begins. He had stored up all kinds of wealth for this life, but he had no preparation at all for the next. Jesus says this is what it's like for someone who is rich, but not rich toward God. We need to gratefully acknowledge that all things come from him, and then we need to make an effort to use what he gives, not just for ourselves, but also to meet the needs of others. See, God gives us wealth to be enjoyed, but also to be employed, to put to use, so that the word of God might go out and reach others, so that people's physical needs can be met. To be rich toward God means spiritual enrichment, not just personal enjoyment. And how tragic it is when people are rich in this world but poor in the next. Now, avarice is not the only problem when it comes to money matters. Verses 22 to 31, Jesus admonishes against anxiety. From the sins of greed and selfishness, Jesus turns to worry, which is in a way connected to the other two. See, greed can never get enough. Worry is afraid it might not have enough. So we've got to be careful not only against the sin of greed and materialism, but also the sin of worry. And yeah, you heard that right. Worry is a sin. Fundamentally, it means a lack of trust in God's ability to meet my needs. When I worry that I'm not going to have enough for the next month, what am I saying to God? I just don't trust that you can provide my needs. When I'm worried about my health, I'm telling God, I don't trust you with my own life. No one would ever say that out loud, but again, our actions speak louder than our words at that point. And he goes on to point out that this obsessional worry about things and about materialism and money, not only is it incompatible with our Christian faith, it's incompatible with common sense. You'll notice that Jesus says here, why don't you just look out at the flowers? Flowers are beautiful, but they don't work for their beauty. It's just there. The birds of the air have enough to eat, but it's because God feeds them. And God clothes the lilies of the field. And if he's going to do that for flowers and birds, don't you think he's going to take care of your needs too? It just doesn't make sense to worry. There's three points about worry that the Bible teaches that we've got to be aware of. Worry is destructive. You know that our English word worry originally comes from the word meaning to strangle. And that's what worry does in our lives. It just strangles us, strangles the life out of us. Corrie ten Boom is quoted as saying, worry does not empty tomorrow of its sorrow. It empties today of its strength. And that's true. You spend time and emotional energy worrying about tomorrow. What are you doing today? You may be in worse shape tomorrow because you're not doing what you need to do today because you're worried about tomorrow. It just doesn't make any sense, Jesus says. Worry is also deceptive. It gives a false perspective of what's truly important. We think that the things here and now are most important. And the things of eternity, well, that can wait. Jesus says, that's foolish. You need to be focused on what's truly important, and that's what's eternal, not the things that are just here on earth. And then finally, worry is deformative. It keeps us from growing. It really makes us like the unsaved in the world. Jesus says in that passage, don't you realize you're acting like the Gentiles when you're worried about stuff? I mean, that's what they do. Don't be like them. You trust God, and God's going to take care of it. The late chaplain of the U.S. Senate, Peter Marshall, once prayed that ulcers would not become the badge of our faith. And that's what we do when we worry too much. And that should not be among Christians. And then finally, Jesus advises about allegiance. In verses 32 through 34, do not be afraid, little flock, for your Father has been pleased to give you the kingdom. Sell your possessions, give to the poor. Provide purses for yourselves that will not wear out, a treasure in heaven that will not be exhausted, where no thief comes near and no moth destroys. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. See, when it comes down to it, money matters are really about our allegiance. They're about our loyalty. What is the most important thing in our lives? If it's money and material things, that's our God. But if God is the most important thing to us, we're going to be investing our time and our talents and our treasures in those things that are going to last. Now, I want you to consider what Jesus is saying. He says, do not store up treasures on earth. Why? Is he saying the treasures are bad? No. He's saying they won't last. It's not just that wealth might be lost, it will be lost. At some point in time, everything you own right now, you're going to lose. You're going to leave it behind. You can't take it with you. You'll never see a hearse pulling a U-Haul. Ever. Mentioned John Rockefeller earlier, the great billionaire. After he died, somebody asked his accountant, how much did John leave? All of it. And that's the truth. Verse 34 concludes, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. See, this is the essential thrust of what Jesus taught about our treasures. It's not the amount of one's possessions, but the allegiance that is emphasized. It's the direction of one's heart, heavenward or earthward, that is all important. See, if we focus more on the gifts than we do the giver, we're guilty of idolatry. If we accept his gifts but complain about them, we're guilty of ingratitude. If we hoard his gifts and not share them with others, we're guilty of indulgence. But if we yield to his will, and if we use what he gives for his glory, we're going to enjoy life and we're going to be satisfied. And we're going to have laid up for us a treasure in heaven. See, our treasures and God's pleasures need to go together. We must look at earth from heaven's point of view and make sure that we're putting God and his kingdom first and foremost in our lives. The main question is, where is your heart? If our hearts are fixed on the material things of earth that are someday going to pass away, we're going to be worrying, we're going to be greedy, we're going to be guilty of all of those sins God warns about. But if we hold things loosely, if we let God take them, if that's his will, we're going to live a life of peace. We're going to have joy regardless of how much we have. See, it's not wrong to own things as long as things don't own us. That's what Jesus taught about money. It's not how much you have or how little you have. Where's your heart? And God demands that he be first. We're going to conclude our service this morning, if you'll take your hymn to hymn number 388. This is a very common invitation type hymn. A hymn of commitment. We often sing the first verse, "Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee." But we're going to sing the third verse this morning. "Take my lips and let them be filled with messages for thee. Take my silver and my gold. Not a mite would I withhold." Are you willing to offer to God everything you have? I'm not saying that he's going to take it from you and leave you destitute. He's going to meet your needs. But are we willing to say, "God, you are in control. And if I have things that somebody else can use more than me, lead me to give them." Don't let money and material things become my God. That's the emphasis of that third verse. Let's stand together as we sing, as we commit ourselves and all we have to the Lord.